Today is February 7, 2014. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Archive, I am interviewing Ken Treadway over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Mr. Treadway, can you begin with when and where you were born?
I was born in Muskogee, Oklahoma. February 14th, 1930. I'm 84 years old this Valentine's Day.
Oh, well, happy birthday coming up.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about your family.
We're Native Americans, Cherokee Indians. We were raised outside of Muskogee, Oklahoma, on what you call a farm that we were sharecroppers. There was nine in the family. The family made $12.50 a month, and we took care of the farm. The owner was good enough to let us live off of the land, and so to speak, that if we wanted to kill an animal for meat, like a cow, we could. And we could grow vegetables, and that helped us get through those depression years in the 30s.
Mm. So how were you first introduced to sports? What was the first athletic thing that you were involved in, or first sport that you were involved in?
Well, back in those days, we had to make our own fun. We all played Annie over. Over the roofs of barns and so forth, and red light and green light and hopscotch and rubber guns. And then we had on weekends, it was normal for the farm boys to meet somewhere and play sandlot baseball. And we had outdoor basketball rims that were usually a rim off of a wagon that had been saved. And we had football to throw around, and we played a lot of dodgeball with bean bags, so to speak. We had little bags that Mom would sew up and have beans in them, and that we used for dodgeball. But in those days, young people had to make their own fun.
Mm-hmm.
And we did have a place on a creek. A creek ran near the through the land, and my dad dammed up an area of it, and it made a real nice little swimming hole. And that's when I first began swimming. First on the farm in a little farm pond, and I just sort of enjoyed swimming, even though I played other sports throughout my high school days, and I never did play college football or anything, but I was a swimmer back in the high school days, and I never did swim in college either.
Mm. Did you have any sports role models or heroes that you looked up to growing up?
Oh, I would say my older brothers. They were good athletes and very good, and I certainly looked up to them. And then as I was growing up, and you had friends older than you, you sort of, they were your heroes, and I looked up to them for that, and a lot of them were very good athletes, went on to University of Oklahoma and other places and became great athletes. In fact, I had one brother who was the Oklahoma High School Football Player of the Year his senior year in high school. He went on to the University of Iowa and played quarterback for the Iowa Hawkeyes under Coach Forrest Evershetsky. Played in the Rose Bowl twice, and then he played in the Senior Bowl. And then my older brother was very good at basketball. And he later did some coaching. And another brother, Jim, played football. He was a lineman. And there were six boys and one girl, and all the boys were active in various sports, and parents encouraged us, and most of us played football, basketball, either baseball and track, and I sort of fell into the sport of swimming.
So tell me how you ended up being part of the 1968 Olympic team.
Well, I had gone to work after finishing junior college. I went to Bartlesville, Oklahoma, and was hired as their aquatics director. And I coached swimming at the Bartlesville YMCA. And then during that period of time of 2 years, Phillips Petroleum Company in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, built a beautiful building, and in the building was a gymnasium, swimming pool, bowling lanes, and we had softball stadiums. Phillips was a great believer in physical activities, and they have one of the greatest industrial recreation programs in the world. And a gentleman, O.M. Bud Browning, was a basketball coach and director of athletics for the Phillips 66 basketball team and for the company. And he was on the board of directors of the YMCA and observed me up close. And when they finished construction on then the Adams Building in 1950, September of that year, Bud called me and wanted me to fill out papers and accept the job as aquatics director and swimming director and coach for Phillips Petroleum Company. And I founded the Phillips 66 Splash Club, which became a very strong club in the nation. And I'm pleased to tell you that that club is still well organized and functioning today. And when you think it was formed in 1950 and still going, that's a great tribute to the parents, because we had a strong parent organization, and because of them, there's still a strong Phillips 66 Splash Club. And I got involved in the Amateur Athletic Union in Oklahoma in swimming. And from that, I got involved nationally as member of the National AAU Swim Committee, and because of some good luck and good swimmers to work with and parents and the backing of Phillips Petroleum Company, I was able to serve as National Chairman of Women's Swimming and National Chairman of Men's Swimming and also Olympic Chairman. And I was chosen by my peers to head up the, I was assistant head manager of the men's Olympic team in 1964 in Tokyo. And then they gave me the opportunity to be the head manager of the women's Olympic team in Mexico City. And then I was the head manager of the 1972 Olympic men's swimming team in Munich, Germany. So it gave me a lot of nice honors. And also the American Swimming Coaches Association have been very good to me over the years and have recognized my work. And then the International Swimming Hall of Fame, I've been inducted there. And then later I was inducted into the Bartlesville Athletic Hall of Fame. And then the old story, if you ever are recognized in your hometown, you've made it. And recently I was elected to the Athletic Hall of Fame in my hometown of Muskogee, Oklahoma, and all of that is because of swimming.
Oh.
And the good people that I had the opportunity to work with over the years.
Wonderful. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. So after you were manager of the women's team in 1968?
Correct.
So what can you tell me about the training and preparation of the team for the altitude in Mexico City?
Well, the altitude of Mexico City, which is over a mile high, was certainly a concern to us even 3 or 4 years in advance of the games. And in our planning, we thought we had to get to altitude. And over those years between 64 and 68, we decided to train out at the Air Force Academy and in Colorado. And they had beautiful facilities. So been working with the people in at the Air Force Academy, approval was granted, and our training period happened at a time when most of the cadets were on vacation, but the incoming freshmen were there, and they have great facilities. We were able to eat in a dining facility with the new incoming cadets, and we had wonderful places to stay. The men's team stayed over at a beautiful Broadmoor Hotel, and the women's team stayed over at a very nice, beautiful accommodation and a motel. And we worked out schedules where the men were trained at different hours and we were trained at different hours. But it helped us some to get to altitude. But knowing what we didn't know at that time, just how tough of a thing it was going to be. By the time we got to Mexico City, even after a month of training at altitude, there was no doubt that we could have used another probably 90 to 120 days of altitude training, which we did not realize at the time that we would need that long. But our swimmers did a great job. In fact, the altitude ended up not being as big a problem as the sickness that some of our people had in Mexico City. Katie Ball, in fact, at that time, the world's record holder in breaststroke, did not get to compete because of illness. And on a men's team, Steve Rarick, who now is a doctor, I believe he had to be disqualified medically while he was standing on the blocks waiting to compete in the 200 meter free, and I believe Steve was qualified in first place. And we had others who had, sometimes 1 or 2 days of sickness, but Katie, that great breaststroker, was really a blow to lose because of illness. So it ended up, I think, that the problems of water and food and so forth in Mexico City may have been worse than the altitude problem.
I see. Someone told me that the women's swimming and women's diving teams were the first to eat in the U.S. Air Force Academy dining hall. The first women to eat there.
In fact, that they were the first women to ever be able to have that honor.
And that they were the first women to ever swim in that facility.
That's correct.
So as you were preparing to go down to Mexico City, did you remember hearing anything or reading anything about the Olympic Project for Human Rights?
Let me tell you before I answer that. This little side note that you'd get a big kick out of. The plumbing in the ladies' quarters was not good, and they could not flush their toilets, and they went out and bought geranium plants, and they just put the geranium plants down in the toilet stools and quit using them, and the geraniums were beautiful. And then also too, they were given roses for winning medals, and when they got back, they would place the roses in the stools.
And this is in the toilets in Mexico City, in the Olympic Village?
And now you're noticing on TV that they're having trouble with toilets in Sochi. But it's a different sport. But when you think about it, 68 and now, for what, 46 years?
Yeah.
But I thought you'd like that little side note that the women were very creative in making what was a real problem they made a lot of fun out of it.
Yeah. That is funny. That's a neat story. Thank you for sharing that. So had you heard anything about that Olympic Project for Human Rights?
I don't understand what you mean about human rights.
Did
you mean you're talking about the Black Power demonstration?
Yeah, the before you went to Mexico City, did you remember hearing or reading anything about possible protests or possible boycotts by some members of the U.S. Olympic team?
No, but after we got there, the track team had some men who were great runners, and in fact, they won a relay or something, and then they got on the award platform and gave the Black Power sign, and they were sent home the next day, thank goodness. But we didn't hear anything about it before we went. I didn't.
Did you hear anything about student protests and violence in Mexico City about 10 days before the start of the games?
Yes, there were some media releases about some protesting, but I thought that had to do with ticket prices and so forth.
Hmm.
But it was very, the coverage was very small, and we just ignored it, so to speak. And then, like I say, the first sign of any protest was done by our own athletes on our team in track and field.
Yeah.
And the United States Olympic Committee did the right thing after they made their protest and demonstration, which had no place in the Olympic Games. They were dismissed from the track team and sent home.
What were your impressions of Mexico City when you first arrived there for the 68 games?
It's a great city, and they worked hard at it, everybody was friendly, and they had gone out of their way in many ways, painting and fixing up things in beautiful colors and good music, and they had good welcome, and the conduct of the games were just great. The only problems was the drinking water and some food problems that people had dysentery and sickness.
Mm.
Overall, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd give them a good 7.
All right. That's a pretty good score. What did you think of the security in Mexico City?
I thought it was pretty good. The biggest problem sometimes was transportation. You had to make connections sometime, the way their transportation was set up. And in fact, one foreign swimmer, and he was a good boy, maybe if capable of winning a gold medal, and he actually did not make it for his event one night, and it was all because of the transportation problems.
That is too bad. What did you think of your accommodations? Were you staying in the Olympic Village?
Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think of those accommodations?
I thought overall they were good. But I did share with you earlier the problem the ladies' swimming team, and I'm sure it happened to other women athletes because they were all over on the women's side of the village. They had plumbing problems. But for the most part, on the men's side, I thought it was very good.
Mm. Going back to that security question I asked you, how would you compare the security in Mexico City in 1968 to the security in Munich in 1972?
Well, unfortunately, you had the Black September terrorist put a big black cloud over the Olympic Games in Munich because of their attack on the Israeli team.
Mm-hmm.
The men's team that I was with at that time, we were probably located only 200 meters across the lawn from the Israeli team, and I knew some of the Israeli people, in fact. And the Black September terrorists were able to slip in through security because of the way that they had dressed. I think going into the Olympic Games that certainly the German people wanted to do everything to help their image following World War II, and they did not want to appear strong with a strong military at the Olympic Village. But they did have security, and the Black September members had uniforms on or sweat clothes on, much like Olympic athletes. They also were carrying what you and I would refer to as athletic bags. So they had every appearance that they were legal, and they came in over the fence at night, early in the morning, in fact, around, I think, maybe 2, 2:30. And when they came in, the security was probably at a minimum level, and they saw them, and they thought, well, those athletes are just coming in late, and we'll give them a little break and ignore it. And now you know the rest of the story, because they had their weapons and everything in those bags, and must have had maps, because I think they had almost a dry run. They knew exactly where they wanted to go and what room numbers the Israelis were in, and it was just a sad situation for any occasion, but at the Olympic Games, it sure put a black cloud over the Munich Games.
I'm sure it did. Was your family in attendance in 68 in Mexico City?
Yes.
No.
I beg your pardon. No, they were in Munich.
Okay.
My daughter Tanya and my wife Betty were in Munich. And I might share with you that that morning there was some talk at the hotel where they stayed about something happening out at the Olympic Village. So my wife was able to make a contact at the desk. And they said, let's turn on the...
No, hairdresser.
Oh, she
didn't tell me anything.
The German people were very quiet, but she had a hair appointment that morning, and the hairdresser said, have you heard about the problem out at the Village? And Betty said, no. So then she turned on the American broadcast armed service radio, and that's how she learned that we were under lockdown and everything at the Village. I was unable to communicate with my family for some time.
Mm.
But that'll tell you the Munich story. Now, one other thing, I personally feel like, that if the minimum security force on duty that night, I believe if they had challenged those guys, those terrorists, and had examined their bags and found what we know they had, I believe they'd have taken them under control and maybe even killed them right there, because the Germans are very capable of good security.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that'll finish the Munich story. You know the rest of that.
Yeah.
Now you asked me a question. I had to interrupt you to finish
the Munich. No, that's okay. The question was about your family and whether or not anybody in your family got to go to the games in 68.
No, we elected not to go because the situation we knew was not as good as it was in Japan as far as health problems. So we were concerned about the health situation.
Mm.
And my wife and daughter did not go to Mexico City.
You misunderstood me, darling. The guards would have been killed, not the September people. The September people would have just killed the guards.
Betty made a point that probably if they had challenged the Black September, the Black September would have probably killed the guards, too.
Mm.
My only question there, being an old military man, is they still got to get their weapons out of the bag and everything. But I don't even know personally whether the German security was carrying weapons on themselves. I don't think they were. But anyway, that puts the Munich game behind us. and you're concentrating on the 68. But we elected a family for health reasons in Mexico City that we're aware of that they shouldn't go, and they did not attend the Mexico games. Mm-hmm. My wife went to Tokyo in 64, and then my wife and daughter went to Munich games in 72.
Mm. What can you tell me about the opening ceremony in 1968?
Yes, there's a beautiful, beautiful opening ceremony.
Mm-hmm. Any strong memories from that opening ceremony? What do you remember the
most?
You
know, I tell you, when you stop and think about the opening ceremonies, it's like a big parade. And you come in, and you're given recognition as a country, and you line up on the field, and then they raise the flags, and they give you the Olympic oath, and the president of the country, the host country, is introduced, and he says a few words, and then the International Olympic Committee president, he comes to the microphone and says, "Let the games begin," and that's the kickoff. But it's a beautiful, beautiful celebration when you stop and think how many thousands of great athletes are all assembled together representing so many countries of the world. It's a wonderful atmosphere, a great environment. You remember those things the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's how many people ever get the opportunity to represent their country in the Olympic Games.
Did you have any close friends who were also there working for the Olympic Committee or, you know, as part of the team, or did you make any close friends
sure.
while you were there?
I knew a lot of the United States people who were in attendance, mm-hmm. in addition to the swimming and diving. Certainly knew track and field people and the wrestling people. And in 1964, I had become acquainted with a lot of people from various countries of the world, and it was good to see them again. Like it's sort of like a reunion, because in the Olympic Village you have an international cafe or restaurant, and you go there and eat. And at that time, I always made it a practice to sit with people from different countries of the world, just to visit with them and so forth. And I had a lot of friends from countries of the world that's where we could meet and talk and share experiences. And later on, I was able to visit a lot of those countries representing Phillips. And those men, a lot of them served as my personal host when I was in their countries.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great tradition that you have once you meet people around the world, you hope to see them again.
Mm-hmm. Did political tensions and Cold War political tensions affect your ability to interact with members of the Soviet bloc teams?
Well, you know, naturally, in the Olympic Games, when a country is awarded them, they start preparing for it, and they try to be better than maybe the Olympics before them, and they work hard at it. But I never had any problem personally, political ways or otherwise, with the Russians. You had to be very firm with them. I will share with you an experience. I remember one time when we had been out for a late workout and getting back into the international restaurant. I was lined up with the athletes waiting to be served, and a Russian coach and another couple of people and about six athletes came in, and they just walked up through the line. And I went up and just said to them, let's recognize the fact that these people here have been waiting to go in line. You just cannot come in and get up to the front of the line. And, hey, he just told his people to get to the back of the line. And that was the only thing that ever happened that I ever had to take care of, which I thought had to be taken care of for the benefit of not only our athletes that I was with, but there were other countries lined up there, too. And you know what? Later, that head man of the Russian delegation saw me and thanked me for what I had done. He said they did not know, but he did.
Oh, huh. So what can you tell me about the drug testing program that was implemented in 1968 at the Games?
Well, you're talking about for drugs?
Yes, the urinalysis that they collected.
Oh,
from...
urinalysis, mm-hmm. Okay. Well, also, too, let me tell you that I think for the most part, that's just my personal feeling, I think that for the most part, the people representing the various countries of the world, when they go to the Olympic Games, I think for the most part, they just leave political matters behind. They're there for the Olympic Games and to compete, and I just never did think that there was much politics. The politics seemed to come more from the media. Media likes to stir up the politics for controversy. And then going back to your analysis test, I don't remember us having any problems. And, you know, that was done by random. In other words, after an event, they would just randomly choose people to come and take the test. But we had no problems, as I recall.
Okay.
If any of the ladies had a problem, they sure didn't call it to my attention. And I think it was pretty well done. And, you know, naturally, the drug testing got a little stronger in the later Olympic Games.
I wanted to ask about comparing the drug testing across the three games that you were at, 64, 68, and 72. What comparisons can you make there?
Well, naturally, they were learning more and more that some people were taking what you would call drugs to steroid-type drugs. And people were bulkier and more muscular and so forth. And this began to show up quite a bit and when we got to the 72 Olympic Games because of the East German women. You know, they were just all bulked up and looked like men weightlifters. And I think that as the Olympics, you know, got older in years, that the drug testing became more sophisticated. And the drug people who were using drugs were able to sort of stay ahead of the testing. But it began to catch up with them more and more in the 72. And naturally, when you think back, what you and I consider drugs for performance drugs really weren't that available in the market and so forth in 64 and 68.
I see. What about the gender verification testing that took place in 68? Do you remember that?
Vaguely. I knew it went on, mm-hmm. and I'm glad it did. You know, you could look at some people's appearance, and by appearance you would say, my goodness, and that's a woman competing in the Olympic Games. And yes, it showed up more, I thought, in the gender of women than it did in men. But I think there was very little of it. My focus was on looking after that great group of women athletes that we had, and I wasn't too much concerning myself with those problems that I had no responsibility for and control over. That is left up to the Olympic medical people and others, doctors, and let them take care of those matters. But I knew there were some questions about some athletes, whether they were women or not.
How did you feel about how your team performed?
Oh, under the circumstances of high altitude, we just had great performances. I'm sorry about the sickness that Katie Ball had, and a few others weren't maybe as strong as we had hoped for, but overall, we had a great, great Olympics, the United States.
Which performance stands out in your mind the most?
Oh, I would say, I just got to tell you and be honest with you, I'm not being political, but I thought our divers did a great job overall, and the swimmers. Now, to pick out a swimmer here and swimmer there, they all did great, but you've got to consider that Debbie Myers, that was a great Olympics for her, mm-hmm. and there were other girls, the backstroker, Watson, Pokey Watson, and we just had a great team of women. Where's that list of the Olympic teams? I don't have it handy, the list of the girls, but all I can tell you is that overall, I thought the United States team I was with had a great Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. And if I had a roster in front of me, I could probably remember some of the events. But, you know, I'm looking back on a long memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just have to tell you that rather than trying to pick out one or two, I've just got to tell you they were just great, great people.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, Mickey King was the great diver in women's diving that year.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, if you remember, she even performed, I think, her last two dives after having an injury to her arm.
Yes, yes.
That you remember that, I'm sure.
Yes, it was unfortunate, but she came back in 72, so that was a happy ending for her.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, Donna DeVerona was also on that team.
Mm.
And Donna had a great Olympics.
Wonderful.
And Kathy Ferguson was the great backstroker. You remember, oh, I'm sorry, I'm looking at 64. I don't have the 68 in front of me, so if you erase what I just said to you.
Oh, that's okay. I knew Donna DeVerona was on the 64 team. That's all right.
Okay, I remembered 64, but my wife just reminded me those were 64 swimmers, and Donna was not on the, no, she wasn't there.
That's
anyway, I would just rather say that as the United States Olympic swimming and diving team, I thought they performed great at Mexico City.
Wonderful. I forgot to ask you this earlier, but what about the trials in 68? What do you remember about the trials and how the team was selected? Do you feel that there were any issues with that, or what are your memories of that?
Well, I can only tell you that the Women's Olympic Committee are the ones that are responsible for deciding on how you're going to be selected to the team. But it's pretty well cut and dried. You take the first and second place in the events, and then if a swimmer doubles, in other words, say a swimmer wins a 100 free and a 200 free, then that means you can pick up an alternate and add to the team. And that helps you in overall strength. And then the way we would pick the people who were going to compete on the medley relay, for instance, your top backstroker in the Olympic Games becomes a backstroker, the breaststroker, the butterfly, and the 100-meter freestyle. And that's cut and dried, very simple.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the freestyle relay, when you get to training camp, you can have time trials or run it like a meet and determine who's your four best swimmers for the freestyle relays. And then naturally, when you get into the Olympic competition, where they place in those individual events can help determine who's going to be on the relays. But usually before the Olympic trials are even held, or maybe a year before, the committee already establishes a cut and dried system for making the team. And I've always thought personally that it was very fair.
Mm-hmm.
Some history for you. Sometime you may want to read the book, 6 Days to Swim. And that was around the great men's swimmer that had the appendicitis attack, Farrell. And he had an operation surgery. He came back and competed in the trials, and he was good enough to make the Olympic team. And then later, his performance in the 60 games permitted him to move up and swim on the relays as well. His name was Jeff Farrell, F-E-R-R-E-L. But overall, I have not heard any complaints by coaches or swimmers on how the Olympic teams were selected. You earned the position.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't give you a position. A lot of people thought that Jeff Farrell, for instance, should be given a position because of his past performances. But Jeff didn't want that, and the committee didn't want that, and he had to compete even after going through surgery.
Mm. It sounds like it was pretty fair.
Oh, no doubt about it. It's been more fair than my 63 years of married life with this gal, Betty, I'm with today. Nothing. She tells me nothing's fair in love and in war. We celebrated our 63rd anniversary.
Oh.
December 31st.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. We've been blessed. Good Lord has blessed us.
Yep, that's a long time to be married. That's wonderful. So,
do you think I deserve a trophy for that?
Yeah, I think you do. Yes.
Well, I think Betty probably better deserves it than me. Putting up with me over all these years. But you're a lot of fun to talk with. And are you doing this as a student, as a report, or?
This is part of a project, a history project or an archive project that I'm helping to manage.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're doing very well at it.
Well,
any other questions?
I have a couple more. I wanted to ask you to compare the media presence and media coverage between 64, 68, and 72.
Okay. I think overall, a broadcast brush. The media was always polite. You go to a press conference, and then later, if someone wants to talk to somebody personally, they'll come to the manager and say, could I arrange a meeting or a press session with Mark Spitz, with Debbie Meyer, with Donna DeVerona, or Mickey King. And then what you do is look at your schedule, and you try to set those sessions up for them. And they were always nice. They were prompt. And you would tell them, you're going to have to hold this to 15 minutes or so. And they never had a problem with that. I always thought the media did very well. And I think they probably were directed by international media people and also United States Olympic Committee people. And they were always very good. In fact, even after the Olympic Games, sometimes the press people would call you and have interviews with you over the phone for articles. And I always enjoyed those.
Hmm.
So I would broad brush, I would say the media was always outstanding, polite, and cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they were fair to in the way they reported on our teams, those that I was with.
Mm-hmm. Did you have the opportunity to attend other events?
No. Your timing, your time is just, it's a 24-hour job every day. when you're looking after a group of young people and great athletes, you better stay on your toes and be there to take care of them as their needs may arise. I was able to see some things on TV when I was in the training pool or in the international restaurant. And for some reason, I did get to see the last 3 or 4 minutes of the marathon. And a man named Abibi won that event. And he was running barefooted, of all things. He was a big, tall gentleman. And a friend of mine on the track team, as I recall, we walked over toward the track stadium. And they told us we couldn't go any further, said, the marathon runners are coming in. So because of our credentials, we went over to the gate and walked in, and we got to see Abibi come in the stadium and run around the track one time to finish it up. And then he laid down over on the grass and started doing exercises after running 26 miles. So I got to see the finish of the marathon in 64.
Oh, wow.
But other than that, you just don't have time to go to the other events.
Mm-hmm.
I think some athletes on the team were able to see some things, but very little.
Abibi was a guard for the king.
What, Kim, what can you tell me about the closing ceremony in Mexico in 68?
I can tell you that the closing ceremonies in 64 were just great. Now, one of the greatest memories I'll ever have in my lifetime was at the final event at the swim stadium was the men's relay. Now, think about history. The United States won the gold medal, first place. And then the second and third places went to Japan and Germany, the two countries that we had been at war at in war with in 19 and, or, you know,
2014.
In other words, in World War II, those three countries had been to war. And then in 64, at the Olympic Games in Japan, those three countries were receiving medals together at the last swimming event of those games. And I don't remember who, but a picture was taken of that scene, and I think it made the Sports Illustrated. But on my left was standing a guy named Tom Kawata.
Ikushima.
And another person was what's his?
No.
Anyway, long story short, we could see people crying, particularly who had been in the war themselves as sailors and soldiers and pilots and so forth. And even one of them walked up to me and tapped me on the shoulder. And he said, Ken, he said, isn't it wonderful that even though we were at war, that now in the Olympic Games, we can be friends and receive the medals together. So that tells you something about the Olympic feeling and atmosphere that I'll never forget.
20 years in between.
Yeah, when you think about when the war ended, you weren't probably born yet, but there was 20 years between the end of the war and those games.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that was the first Olympic Games held in Asia. But anyway, the Japanese did a great job, and the closing ceremonies were outstanding. And then at those games, you marched in as a country. And in 68, we came in as a country. But in 72, I believe they just sort of let it go helter-skelter And you came in as a team and then sort of...
Came in as a team in 72.
And then it broke up at the end. Everybody was together. Of course, now, in 72, I elected not to go to those closing ceremonies because you have, after the Olympic Games, a FINA. FINA is the International Swimming Federation group, and they take all the medal winners and go to some city not far away, and they have a FINA gala. And I had responsibility with that. And also, on a personal note, I was quite concerned for the safety of my family. And so I talked with Betty, and we decided that she and Tanya would go ahead and leave Munich. And they were going to go into Copenhagen, and then I was going to meet them there when I got finished with my job. And and Tanya and Betty both had tickets for the closing ceremonies, and they gave them as gifts to somebody. And they left Munich, and I can assure you there were tears in their eyes, and then they went to Copenhagen. Another historic thing is this taxi driver driving them from the airport in Copenhagen to the hotel. He says, "Ladies, right over there is where the Black September trained for their attack on the Israeli team." And here they were themselves not too far away from where the Black September had trained, and they were in Copenhagen. But I went with the United States swimmers into a town called Regensburg, and we had a wonderful FINA gala. So I did not participate in the closing ceremonies in Munich.
Mm-hmm. What did you do right after the games in 68?
In 68, I finished my job and saw that all the athletes were on their way home. And I myself returned to Bartlesville and went right back to work.
Hmm.
No time in between.
Yeah.
I had a swimming team waiting for me at home.
Yeah. Ken, I wanted to ask you, since you were involved with the Olympic movement and the Olympic organizations over a number of years, what changes in amateurism have you seen during your lifetime, and how do you feel about those changes?
Well, first and foremost, it was really strict rules. You were an amateur. You were not paid for performance. But as the communist countries became involved, either through military assignment or something, it got to be almost amateurs against professionals in some sports, not in all. Basketball, I think, first and foremost, it started showing up that there were really national teams or professional teams who were representing countries rather than the team being selected by a committee like they were in the United States. And you take some of those great performers of some of those countries, there was no doubt that they were being paid athletes. And I don't have any evidence of it, but I heard later years that Russia was even giving very, very top prizes for a gold medal. You won a gold medal, you might get a rank or two performance report promoted in the military or otherwise. But you may get a better apartment. So I think when the communist countries got stronger to compete in Olympic Games, it started a movement in the United States that, hey, if we're going to compete with these professionals, really, we're going to have to do something to reward our athletes. So, you know, they've opened up basketball that our pro athletes do represent the United States mm-hmm. in basketball. Mm-hmm. And I know that there's a lot of money made by track people, as you well know. Mm-hmm. Certainly look at this Winter Games. I would not hesitate to say that probably 50% of the athletes there from around the world are probably paid athletes by some company or something they represent. And I saw a change from strict amateurism to a mixture of pros and amateurs over the years I was involved. Now, is it good or bad? I don't know. But I think that the professionals are only showing up in some sports. Mm-hmm. For instance, you don't have a professional swimming league in this nation like football and baseball and basketball and so forth. But there's no doubt that things changed, and I'm not one to be able to tell you whether it was for the good or bad. But when I was a young man growing up, man, to be an amateur, you couldn't receive anything. In fact, if you remember the great Jim Thorpe, it was all over him throwing a baseball game, and I think he earned about $15. Mm-hmm. And because of that, his Olympic games and wonderful crown that was given to him worth a lot of money. Jim Thorpe was ripped of all of his awards because of pitching in a baseball game for $15.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a really interesting time in history.
Yes.
So, Ken, what has been the impact, positives or negatives, of being involved in the Olympic movement on your life?
Well, I think as far as having an impact on my life, it has been very beneficial to me in the way of an education, of learning about other countries of the world and the people. And I have learned that people are people from any country all over the world. They would like to have a good environment in which to live. They'd like to have a good job. They'd like to be able to practice their religious faith. And I think all of them that I came in contact with and knew personally and visited with, they all wanted someday maybe to come to the United States of America. And I had several that would even ask me if I would help them to become an American citizen. So I learned that the American way of life was really desired by the peoples of the world, and I still see that today.
Great impact on you.
Mm.
And I hope that in my association with coaches and managers and Olympians, that I had some impact the other way.
Yeah, I can see that.
But I think I'd have to admit that the Olympic movement and my experiences have been able to help me grow as an individual. And I think it helped me in my professional career. I think being a husband, a father, and a citizen, I think all that experience had an impact on me.
Mm-hmm. What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
To give what?
What one piece of advice would you give today to someone who wanted to be in the Olympics one day?
Well, I would say that first of all, they've got to look at the word of perseverance, because when you stop and think how many hours of hard work that a gold medal winner or a silver or bronze or even being on a team, just think of all the hours and all the effort they put in. And if you're in a final event, some of them only last less than a minute. And all those years are put in a capsule into that length of time. And you just have to learn that it takes hard work and years of perseverance and dedication, commitment to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you owe certainly respect to those who've helped you, your teammates, your coach, your parents, and your great country. And I think that Olympians, you know, in life, everything is not always on the upside. I think that Olympians have to learn that there's downside to the upside, and you have to be able to live through and work through the downside in order to get the glory at the end. And today, I've got to tell you that I admire these Olympians because I know the many, many hours and work that's put forth. I respect and appreciate their parents for supporting them because they have heartache along with the Olympians as they develop.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely true. Well, Ken, is there anything else that you would like to tell me about or to get on record either about 68 or about any of the other Olympic Games that you were a part of?
Well, not really. There's some things that I wish that would happen that may never happen, but I think that something should be thought about by TV producers or something. I think that a 30-minute documentary of the United States Olympic teams every 4 years should be made every school in the nation, and to show that several times a year as at an assembly for the students. I think our young people need to be in on more history, certainly, of our great country, and then they need to see young people, their healthy bodies, and how they show their respect of the American flag, and how they show respect of the country, and how proud they are to be an American. And I'd like to see that happen. And I think the Olympic movement, the Olympic story, and letting them see fellow Americans performing and so forth in a short documentary would be a great thing for patriotism for our young people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think so, too. I think that's a great idea. Well, Ken, is there anything else you'd like to add before we close the interview today?
Well, not really. You've been a joy to visit with, and you've done a great job with the interview. You've hit on some questions that I didn't expect, and that was good. I know, to sum up on what we were just talking about, some of the things that I had a great pleasure with was when I returned from each of the Olympic Games, I was asked by schools, service clubs, other organizations to come and speak about the Olympic Games that I just returned from. And I always enjoyed that, and I thought that helped do a lot along the line of what I was talking about. And I think the United States people are proud people to see our athletes when they come home, to get close up close to them and personal.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that they'll do that after the Winter Games in the Soviet Union. Let's hope and pray that nothing happens by terrorists during these games or any of them in the future.
Mm-hmm. That's true. We should definitely hope for that. Well, Ken, thank you so much for being generous with your time and with your memories today. I really appreciate it. It was wonderful speaking with you.
Well, same to you, and I wish my memory was better than it is.
I think it was fine. You did wonderful.